from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. This week, we go back to a story that we were supposed to do a couple of weeks ago. We talked about that old dark Archduke Ferdinand and the car that he and his wife Sophie were in when they were assassinated in Sarajevo in 1914. And we were supposed to talk about someone else who got into the back seat of their car and didn't get out. Yes, New Year's Day, 1952. In a baby blue caddy in the Oak Hill Mountains of West Virginia, a famous, wonderful country singer. And all will be revealed in 30 laps. And talking about those cars where stars met their untimely end, or well-known people. How about despot cars? We look at the cars that most notorious leaders, you could call them dictatorships. The dictatorships, the famous leaders, and all this macabre stuff at the House of Laps this week. That baby blue Cadillac that was his last ride, and the cars of notorious world leaders. From one extreme to the other this week, let's get into it. And we start. With Hank Williams. That wasn't Hank, that was a mate of his, Farron Young. But don't let that fool you. Let's talk about Hank for a while. And this article first appeared in the Atlanta Journal, the Constitution, December 30, 2002. And was written by Charles Carr. Just before sunrise on New Year's Day, 50 years ago, a sleek baby blue Cadillac roared up the rural Oak Hill Mountains in West Virginia. To the hospital in the cold Appalachian darkness. The driver was just 17, exhausted and scared. The passenger was barely 29 and dead. At the wheel was Charles Carr, a college freshman on Christmas break from Auburn, the man in the back seat with singer-songwriter Hank Williams. I ran and explained my situation to the two interns that were in the hospital, said Carr, now a 67-year-old Montgomery businessman. They came out and looked at Hank and said, he's dead. I asked him, can't you do something to revive him? One of them looked at me and said, no, he's just dead. Was the last ride that would define American music and pop culture for decades to come. Long before there was Janis Joplin or Jimi Hendrix or Kurt Cobain, self-destructive car stars who flamed out at their zenith, there was Hiram Hank Williams, a hard-drinking, rough, around-the-edges Alabama country boy who wrote simple, hard-tugging, heart-tugging songs about loneliness, and then, still young, died alone in the back seat of his car. The last hours of his troubled life long ago passed from reality to myth. Biographers have breathlessly speculated about what really happened. Officials have issued sketchy reports that only increased the mystery. Songwriters and playwrights still rhapsodise about it. An off-Broadway play, Hank Williams' Lost Highway, is currently running in New York. A website dedicated to Williams estimates that more than 700 songs have been written about the singer, whose own recording career lasted just 5 years.
Next Sunday, darling, is my birthday. A day that should be free from care.
But only Carr knows the truth about those final hours. For years, he avoided most requests for interviews. But in recent years, he's begun to talk, trying to set the record straight. He thinks Williams died, the official cause was heart failure, somewhere between Bristol, Tennessee and Oak Hill, on the way to a New Year's Day concert in 1953 in Canton, Ohio. The coincidence is so incredible that I initially suspected that it might be a hoax, that perhaps the Graff and Stift company had fitted with the plate retrospectively. A couple of things suggested this was not the case, however. First, the pregnant meaning of the initial A applies only in English. I'm certainly not an authority on Hank Williams, said Carr, but I'm the only authority on Hank Williams's death. Some biographies have speculated that Williams died in a Knoxville hotel, that porters unwittingly placed his corpse in his car for the trip north. Still others have him dying on the road with an unfinished song in his hands, bedroom slippers on his feet and a pint of vodka in his coat pocket. All bunk, reports Carr, who maintains Williams was very much alive and wearing a white cowboy boots and a stylish blue overcoat and a white fedora when he left Knoxville at 10:45 p.m. New Year's Eve en route to a concert 500 snowy miles north. The story seems to get better as every year goes by, said Carr. But Hank's life doesn't need to have anything added to it. It was sensational enough as it was. By the time Carr got behind the wheel of Williams' ragtop Cadillac on December 30, 1952, the troubadour's life was in full tilt meltdown. He was divorced from his first wife, Audrey. Though remarried, he was staying at his mother's downtown Montgomery boarding house, having been demoted from the Grand Ole Opry to the Louisiana Hayride, the farm team of country music. He was taking morphine shots for constant back pain after major surgery the year before. He suffered from spina bifida. Ingesting a dangerous sedative, chlorophyll hydrate to sleep, and playing the same Blackwater backwater clubs he'd escaped just a few years earlier. Williams knew Carr's father, who ran a Montgomery taxi service, and the teenager was asked to drive an obviously ailing Williams to gigs in Charleston, West Virginia, and Canton, major concert dates that Williams hoped would start a comeback. Dad was a friend of Hank's and tried to look out for him in the tough times, Carr said. He was there talking with Dad, and Hank asked me if I'd be interested in making the trip. It was a journey that seemed doomed from the start. By the time Carr helped Hank load his guitars and stage suits into the car trunk, the weather across much of the South was deteriorating. Rain was turning to ice and snow. Carr recalls the 6'2" Williams was sick and frail at the time, weighing perhaps 130 pounds. But disputes reports that the singer, a long and heavy drinker, was guzzling booze most of the trip. He had a very low tolerance for alcohol at that point, Carr said. We bought a six-pack of beer in Montgomery before we left, and there were several cans left when he died. A rudimentary autopsy found Williams had traces of alcohol in his blood when he died, but it was found no drugs, although it's unclear if pathologists tested for them. Carr remembers Williams being in good spirits as the trip began. They told jokes, sang songs, and traded tales as they navigated the two-lane highways of the pre-interstate South. Hank's song, Jambalaya, was just on the radio, and he asked me what I thought of it, Carr recalled. I told him I didn't care for it, that it didn't make much sense to me. Hank laughed and said, "You son of a bitch, you just understand the French like I do. We were just a couple of young guys on a car trip having fun." They spent the night at a hotel in Birmingham and got an early start on New Year's Eve as the weather continued to worsen. Carr remembers Williams buying a pair of bonded bourbon, a pint of bonded bourbon in Fort Payne, Alabama. He also made one waiter very happy. He walked up to our server at a restaurant that we ate at and said, "Here's the biggest tip you ever got," and he gave him $50. Money meant nothing to Hank. It was snowing by the time they reached Chattanooga, and Williams decided to try and catch a flight from Knoxville to make the Charleston show on time. The flight took off at 3:30 p.m., but was turned back due to the bad weather, so they found themselves stuck in Knoxville for the night. The Charleston show was a bust, but they still hoped to make Canton. Carr got them a room in a 17-story Andrew Johnson Hotel, and they checked in about 7 p.m. to wait out the storm. "We talked a while and ordered dinner up in the room," Carr said. "As I remember, Hank didn't eat much of anything. He had the hiccups real bad." Carr called a doctor who came in and gave Hank 2 injections, later determined to be morphine mixed with vitamin B12. He calmed down after that, but looking back, maybe the hiccups or indigestion could have been the beginning of a coronary, Carr said. Williams dozed off fully clothed, but about 10:30 p.m., Carr got a call from the concert promoter telling him they had to leave right away and drive through the night to make the Canton show.
"Tonight my head is bowed in sorrow. I can't keep the tears from my eyes. My son calls another man daddy. The right to his love I've been denied."
There was some kind of penalty clause in his contract, so he had to be there for New Year's Day or else. "When we left the room, they sent a wheelchair," Carr said. "They rolled him down to the car and Hank got in on his own. I clearly remember that." Carr said there was little traffic as they pulled out of Knoxville. "What traffic you did see was moving at a slow pace because the roads were so bad." Carr said, "We've been trying to push it, but we didn't have much luck." Carr got a ticket about an hour later in Blaine, Tennessee, when he almost ran into a patrolman while trying to pass another car. He paid the fine and got back behind the wheel, with Williams asleep in the back. It was after midnight by this time, already New Year's Day, and Carr had been behind the wheel since early that morning. The teenager stopped in a small town to gas up and get a bite to eat. Carr said it could have been Bristol, Tennessee, about 120 miles northeast of Knoxville, or it could have been Broomfield, a town in West Virginia. It was dark, he was bone-tired and in unfamiliar territory. He specifically remembers a service station on one side of the highway and a dinner and cab stand on the other. He pulled in to gas up. "I remember Hank got out to stretch his legs and I asked him if he wanted a sandwich or something," Carr said, "and he said, 'No, I just want to get some sleep.' I don't know if that was the last thing he said, but it was the last thing I remember him telling me." At the cab stand, Carr picked up a relief driver who helped him drive for a few hours before getting out somewhere in rural West Virginia. Carr drove on and became increasingly concerned about the eerie silence in the back seat. He pulled off the road to check on Williams, who was lying with his head toward the passenger seat and his left hand across his chest. He had his blue overcoat on and a blanket over him that had fallen off, Carr said. "I reached back to put the blanket back over him and I felt a little unnatural resistance from his arm." Carr pulled into the next service station he saw and told the owner he needed to get to a hospital fast. The man pointed the way, and Carr remembers seeing a road sign for Oak Hill 6 miles away. And that, folks, is where the story started. Anyway, on a bright December day a few weeks ago, Carr strolled through the Hank Williams Museum in downtown Montgomery. He sat for a few minutes in the driver's seat of the Cadillac he had driven that night. The overcoat that Williams was wearing is in a glass case nearby, as is one of his pearl-handled pistols and a shoeshine kit he used as a boy to help his family. Carr moved on after that long-ago brush with fame. He went back to Auburn University and got a degree, served in the military, got married, had kids, and became a successful businessman. He now has a home in Montgomery and a weekend lake house. He has a framed poster for the concert that he and Williams never got to. And he keeps a pair of cowhide gloves the singer gave him on that final trip. He'll attend a New Year's Day memorial service for Williams at his much-loved visited grave in Cowboys Band, and will be there. His Cowboys Band will be there as well. They're all old men now, some of them in their 80s. "But I'm not going to make of a day of it," Carr said. "I just want to honour Hank." A visitor observes that Carr has survived the years about as well as the old Cadillac, which has been immaculately restored. Carr laughs at the suggestion. "Oh no," he said, "I'm an old man, but Hank Williams never had to worry about that. He'll always be young to me." And that was attributed to Charles Carr back in 2013. So there we have it, hey? What a sad final trip, as so many of them were. Where is it now? Well, let's go to roadsideamerica.com. The car, its backseat off limits to everyone, is the centrepiece of the Hank Williams Museum in his hometown of Montgomery. Manager Beth Petty is protective of the exhibits, as she is of Hank's legacy. Most of the displays, memorabilia and portraits can never be photographed, per the wishes of those who loaned those items to the museum. "We've got cameras everywhere," Beth told us. She meant surveillance cameras, ready to spot any smitten Hank fan trying to sneak a shot with a smartphone. The museum is a required stop on any Hank Williams or country music pilgrimage. In addition to the car, it displays relics such as Hank's boyhood shoeshine box that we talked about, a sofa from his house, the last microphone he ever sang into. Several shots of his nudie suits are on display as well. Nudie suits were gaudy outfits created by Nudie Rodeo Tailors of Hollywood. Fantastic. Well, that's just my opinion, right out there. Anyway, combined with Hank's custom-made cowboy boots and colourful neckties, also on display, and the car, it's clear that Hank Williams understood bling long before there was a name for it. Hank was wearing a nudie suit when he died. It's also an exhibit. It resembles a superhero outfit or a jumpsuit from Space 1999. The death car itself, a beautiful 1952 Cadillac, was put to practical use for years after Hank's death by the Williams family. Hank Williams Jr. drove it when he was in high school, and years later he had the car restored and displayed in his Nashville museum. On February the 8th, 1999, the death car was returned to Montgomery with the opening of the Hank Williams Museum, delighting its founder, Cecil Jackson, who as a teenager had rotated the tyres on the vehicle a week before Hank's death. Cecil, who passed away in 2010, commissioned an oil painting of Hank's last departure from Montgomery, his 17-year-old driver, the Cadillac, and Hank, which hangs next to the car. Some friendly advice for visitors who may not grasp all the nuance of country music: don't mention Hank and Elvis Presley in the same breath. Hank Williams' eggshell blue caddy preceded Elvis's pink Cadillac by 3 years. And long before the King, Hank had a pair of blue suede shoes, and they're also on display. When we mentioned Elvis to Beth Petty, she quickly put things into perspective. Hank, she said, recorded 225 songs in his brief 5-year career. a pace that would have blown any Elvis away had Hank died not so young. And Elvis never wrote any of his own music, she said.
I'm a rolling stone, all alone and long, for a life of sin I have paid the call. When I pass by, all the people say, just another guy on the lost highway.
Yes, folks, that was his lost highway. Anyway, let's change the subject. Not completely, but let's change the subject. Dictatorship cars. Cars of the most notorious world leaders. Let's have a little... Let's have a look at a couple, shall we? I think we've already touched on Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin in previous episodes. And even Emperor Hirohito. So let's look at Chairman Mao. He had a Hongi red flag. Chinese dictator Chairman Mao chose a Hongi red flag for his travels. The company that introduced the red flag in 1958 is now known as China FAW Group. It built 1,500 of them in a 24-year production run. Or Fidel Castro. Cuban communist leader Fidel Castro was famously in cahoots with the Soviet Union, leading to the Cuban missile crisis of 1962. It also led Castro to becoming the proud owner of a 1963 Zill 111 cabriolet limousine, so gifted to him by Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Kim Jong-il, a Mercedes-Benz 600 Grosseur. Kim Jong-il, deceased Supreme Leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the self-given name of North Korea, was another Mercedes enthusiast. His patronage supports the popular view that the 600 Grosseur was the ultimate dictator's car. Mikhail Gorbachev. The last leader of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev stayed local to the Zill Mark. The 410152 limousine was on Russian government duty right up to 2007. 18 years after its 1989 debut, Gorbachev actually disliked the Soviet elite having nice cars to waft around in, claiming they shouldn't enjoy such privileges over and above the people of the USSR. Mikhail Gorbachev is the odd one out here. He's still alive. Muammar al-Gaddafi. Gaddafi, tyrant as he was, did at least have the health and happiness of the planet at heart. He was allegedly a big collector of electric cars and other environmentally friendly vehicles. He even commissioned an Italian coach builder, Castagna Milano, to build a one-off electric Fiat 500. Fiat's only electric 500 is green with no doors. Can you picture it? I can't somehow. Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, finds less fame than his son Uday for extravagant taste in cars. While Uday collected Ferraris and Porsches, Saddam preferred something more sedate. He confiscated a 1958 Bentley S1 Continental to join his Mercedes-Benz Grosseur. Its owner wouldn't sell it to him, apparently. Tito. Josip Tito. You remember him? Yugoslavian dictator Josip Broz Tito is considered the figurehead for one of the world's most successful communist dictatorships. In his time in the Yugoslav president between 1953 and 1980, Tito frequented the back seat of many specialist Mercedes-Benz limousines. As is becoming apparent, the three-pointed star is a firm favourite for some of the world's most divisive leaders. Benito Mussolini. Italian dictator Mussolini was more patriotic in his choice of cars. A succession of Lancia is topped by his special commission Astura model, including cabriolets for parades and a streamlined version for his private use. And finally, Robert Mugabe. You can guess what he had, of course. Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe seemingly wanted to make more impact than even a Mercedes 600 was capable of. In spite of his own criticism of the West, and Britain in particular, he was a sucker for a vintage Rolls-Royce. And we'll just reiterate to finish off with Joseph Stalin. Following the defeat of Hitler and the Nazis in World War II, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin was sometimes ferried around in the homegrown Zil 1115. This 8-ton armoured monster was produced between 1946 and 1947. The paranoid Stalin wouldn't use any of the 32 cars made for him for more than 2 days. I think that was a similar thing to sleeping too. He never slept in the same place for more than a couple of days or 3 days at once. Our friend Anonymous seems to have written this. It came from Motoring Research from the 4th of March 2020. Dictatorships, cars of the most notorious world leaders. That's a bit of fluff we could thought might be of interest to you all. And we've come to the end of our Hank Williams ride, and we've come to the end of our dictators' notorious motor vehicles of choice. I hope you enjoyed our little story today on Hank, and we thank the great, late, great Hank for his soundtrack this afternoon. Have a listen to some of his stuff. It's pretty good. It's quite amazing with a number of these stars and their untimely demise. There's always a bit of mystery and myth surrounding it, and the true circumstances will probably never come out for a lot of them. But I thought that was an interesting story that you might have liked to have heard today. And I look forward very much to bringing you more stories next week. If you've got the opportunity to spend 30 minutes and we'll do 30 laps, I'd love to have your company. Until then, Richard Lyon, 30 Laps with Dick. We'll see you later. Thank you.